You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with George Abraham. George, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's really exciting to be here.
George, we're talking, of course, still in the pandemic, close to Christmas on the 20th of December in 2020. You're in Florida, but usually you're based out of Somerville because of your PhD. What's happening for you in terms of mobility and your work and study during the pandemic this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a wild ride, honestly. I haven't been home to Florida to see my family in over a year at this point. And I was really going back and forth on whether or not to come back. And I just suited up and wore several layers of gloves, sanitized at every station. Like, I really just took the most anxious route possible with the travel, but was able to successfully travel and quarantine and test for COVID and everything, thankfully. But yeah, it was just really anxiety inducing and awful. But I hope it was the right decision to see some family over the break for a little bit. But my work has been really odd ever since the pandemic as well. Both on the PhD side, in terms of research, we can't really go into lab as much, and I do human subject of non-invasive human subject human motor control experiments, and that has sort of taken a pause and because of getting subjects. But the good
so
news
just,
is
let me yeah. just put a frame around that. This is your PhD
yes.
that you're pursuing in bioengineering at Harvard
yes.
University, right? That's
yes.
that's your side gig while you're writing poetry, right?
Yeah, yes. That's exact. I love that framing because people often think the opposite. People often are saying, "Oh, is poetry your side gig while science is your main gig?" And I definitely think, especially as of now, it's the opposite. And poetry has sort of taken over my life in the best way. And I'm also a faculty member, junior affiliated faculty member in writing, in literature and publishing at Emerson College right now. And that was really, they have gotten very creative about how we're doing COVID right now. And we're on a flex program where every Tuesday I teach on Zoom and every Thursday I teach in person. And that would allow us to de-densify the buildings by 80%. It's weird. I teach behind plexiglass and I have a microphone to project to my students. So it's weird and intangible, especially for poetry, because we want to sit near each other. We want to look at each other and discuss poetry. And it's a pretty intimate class. There was only 13 people in my class this past semester, but it was just weird, I guess. But necessary. I think everyone was being super respectful of COVID. And if there was ever any doubt that they, like, if they didn't get their testing in on time or anything, they immediately were just like, my students were really great and on it and respectful and did not show up to class and zoomed into class instead.
So I want to hear about your, I know you're going to read from your book Birthright, but I feel like I should ask you a little bit about bioengineering, because that's such a kind of unusual and fast-growing and also a field that seems to have all the hallmarks of science fiction fantasies with it. So just to, I guess, briefly talk about that, why a PhD in bioengineering? What's the interest there specifically for you? Is it a specific interest within bioengineering?
I think it's more of a, I guess, framework interest, because I actually was a math major in undergrad, and I think the reason I was so drawn to math is similar to why I was drawn to poetry, in that I see math as a discipline of framework building, of almost like language building, and trying to take a problem and assign a sort of logical framework to that problem by which we can solve and more deeply interrogate that problem. And so I'm, therefore, I guess, in thinking about math, I was like, well, I can go into the pure math, which my undergrad was in pure math. But then I was like, I don't know if I'm really interested in framework for the sake of framework building, which is kind of what led me to the more applied math side, which led me in engineering. I was a double major in math and electrical engineering. So I kind of already knew I wanted to be on the more applied math side of things. But then when I got to grad school, I thought there was a certain versatility to bioengineering in particular that I didn't really see in the other engineering fields. And the math itself lended itself to be really fascinating because biological problems are so complex and so, especially within neuroscience, which is what I study, the sort of just magnitude of complexity lends itself to much more interesting mathematical questions, if I can be selfish for a minute. And so that's kind of what drew me to that field, actually, was that complexity and that rigor and that intent of language building and framework building, more so than, I guess, the actual. I didn't go out saying, yes, I want to be a neuroscientist, or yes, I want to go into biological engineering. It just kind of happens to be the area that I think is more interesting from that framework perspective.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So let's talk about your book. This is from your new book that came out this year called Birthright, and you're going to read us something from it?
Yes. Birthright came out this April, right on the brink of the pandemic. It was a wild ride. And I think that, I guess, as a project, I think that a lot of my sort of math and engineering brain come to fruition with the poems. In terms of form, I think of form very much like I think of memory and like I think of just this larger process of framework building. When we think about assigning a form to a poem, we're sort of giving it a neural capacity almost. We're sort of giving it a reckoning with memory. We're assigning the nature of memory to a poem in a way. And so I was really interested in that throughout this book. And also specifically from my background as a member of the Palestinian diaspora, who lives in the U.S. South, there's a lot of sort of disembodiments and distances that are implicit to that experience that I've lived. And I think that I've been trying to reach towards a poetic of disembodied memory throughout this book. And I think this first poem is actually the best poem to the most successful within the book, I think, that reaches towards disembodied forms of memory. And so should I just go ahead and...
Sure, just...
Great.
Absolutely.
This is in an invented form, so maybe we can talk about the form after I read the poem. But it was written in response to, within the West Bank, some Israeli settlers came to a vineyard, a Palestinian vineyard, in Halhul, which is near Hebron, and overnight they vandalized the vineyard with a chainsaw and graffitied, "We will reach everywhere," on the building. So this is Ekphrasis with toothing chainsaw in unnamed Halhu vineyard. A Markov sonnet. The warak, empty of chlorophyll, hung chewed and dangling because there was no witness amidst the yellowing foliage. The toothing beast's rapture, heavy in the air like a song. Because there was no witness amidst the yellowing foliage. The toothing beast's rapture, heavy in the air like a song, unfamiliar to soil-worn hands, harvesting small implosions. The toothing beast's rapture, heavy in the air like a song, unfamiliar to soil-worn hands. harvesting small implosions, a marble heaven built over hill and tomb reaches everywhere, unfamiliar to soil-worn hands, harvesting small implosions, a marble heaven built over hill and tomb reaches everywhere, the unyellowed muting wind can neither stain nor uproot, a marble heaven built over hill and tomb reaches everywhere, the unyellowed muting wind can neither stain nor uproot a land ungodded, the dead's hollow, hallowed roaring. The unyellowed muting wind can neither stain nor uproot a land ungodded, the dead's hollow, hallowed roaring silence, interrupted by riot of metal teeth and ricochet, a land ungodded, the dead's hollow, hallowed roaring silence. Interrupted by riot of metal teeth and ricochet, a country can only be accountable for the screams, silence. Interrupted by riot of metal teeth and ricochet, a country can only be accountable for the screams we cannot unhear or unwrite from our memory. A country can only be accountable for the screams we cannot unhear or unwrite from our memory, a history unfragmented, free of limbs disfigured. We cannot unhear or unwrite from our memory, a history unfragmented, free of limbs disfigured. Would you believe me if I said I bled for this? A history unfragmented, free of limbs disfigured. Would you believe me if I said I bled for this? Leaves caught in my throat like a contradiction. Would you believe me if I said I bled for this? Leaves caught in my throat like a contradiction. Name, 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 unname, name, 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 unname, name. Leaves caught in my throat like a contradiction. Name, 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 unname, name, 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 unname. Name the wadduk, empty of chlorophyll, hung chewed and dangling. Name, 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 unname, name. Name, 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 unname, name. The wadduk, empty of chlorophyll, hung chewed and dangling, because there was no witness amidst the yellowing foliage.
Thank you, George. Such a powerful poem. Let's talk a little bit about the form, which you said is an invented form, is a form of your own?
Yes. Thank you for, that poem always just kind of takes the breath. it's just an intense journey, so thank you for giving me the space to read it.
Well, it is. I mean, I want to talk about that too, how is that a different form?
So the sonnet, of course, when we think of a sonnet, we think of just that 14-line, nice little, almost logical box of poetry. There can be certain impositions of meter, certain impositions of rhyme onto the sonnet, but more lately, the more contemporary sonnet has sort of abandoned that and has sort of hinged on the volta, the turn. That's the big hallmark quality of the sonnet that has lasted throughout these centuries. And so I was thinking about that sonic as a logical device, simultaneously to troubling the sonnet as, again, a logical sort of finite memory system. And in other words, I was trying to ask, what does the sonnet's capacity to hold memory look like when memory itself is slippery, is nonlinear, is finite in its capacity, even more so than the small 14-line imposition. And so in writing about this violence, this that I'm witnessing through diaspora, that I'm experiencing through a disembodied disconnection, not through a direct connection. It is an intangible connection. I exist in America. I can't directly say that I experience this kind of violence and that the Palestinian people in Palestine witness and feel but I also feel it in a sort of nonlinear way. So I was thinking about how I can write into that distance, write into that inaccess of memory and experience. And so when thinking about that, my science brain clicked in and led me to think about the Markov chain. So the Markov chain is a probabilistic model where you can model sequences of events such that one event is only influenced by the former event and therefore only directly influences the next event. Like, you can't say that your event today will influence the event 2 days from now. It can only influence the event the next day in the causal framework. And so I was thinking about that and thinking about sort of triplets of cause, action, effect. That's kind of what we look at for a Markov chain. You can only look at an action from its cause, the event immediately preceding it, to the event coming right after it, the effect. And so in thinking about that sort of causal framework, I was wondering if we could sort of parse apart and isolate the sonnet into these cause, action, effect triplets, i.e. reading lines 1, 2, and 3, then break, 2, 3, 4, break, 3, 4, 5, break, and so on. And then it wraps around to the 14th line, then the first, and then the second line at the end. And sort of in that sort of framework, how does accountability shift within this poem? How does access to memory shift? How does it, how is memory gained and then lost? What does that process look like? I was interested in seeing that kind of disembodiment at work within the sonnet, as opposed to sort of seeing it all together. Because if you see this poem all together, it's really clear from the beginning to the end who is speaking in this poem, and that speaker's complacency within this violence. But that's lost in this sort of disembodiment in this form. And I think that that loss is itself what I was trying to reach for in this poem.
That's so interesting. And so to talk about also the kind of pathos, your energy, your emotion, your exhaustion at the end of the poem.
Mm.
It's so interesting that you're a scientist and a poet and the scientist of the type that you are, or the researcher that you are at this point. And it's, This kind of I guess pathos is the word, right?
Mm.
What is happening there? There's something so strong. There's something very, you know, incredibly emotional and psychological, but it's also almost draining. It's performative in a way.
Right.
There's something that's, of course, very affecting to me, but like you're saying, even more for you. There's an experience you're having while
reading.
Right.
And I think that comes from my, I actually grew into poetry through slam poetry and spoken word. And while I think a lot of the poetry I'm interested in right now exists very much on the page, I'm trying to do these formal things, these visual things that naturally lend themselves to being experienced on the page visually. I think that every single poem, I also consider the performance of it and the inhabiting of a voice. It's one thing to say that I produce this voice, this little speck of consciousness into the world and it just exists. And it's another thing to say I'm going to physically embody that voice for you and to be present with that voice. And I don't think I ever, even though I don't consider myself really a slam poet as much nowadays, I do think that I've never, ever, ever going to write a poem that I would not know how to read in front of an audience, and that I wouldn't know what I want the voice to sound like or accomplish in the reading. And I think it's so valuable. I think that every poet, regardless of if they're more of a performance poet or page poet or anything in between, because I think those distinctions are arbitrary, it's all poetry, it's all sound at the end of the day. I think every poet needs to really rigorously study their poems and how to read their poems and how to exist with their poems and how to become their poems. And I think that's so valuable for everyone, honestly.
I think so, too. And that sounds like such a kind of an ethic almost from slam poetry, as you were saying, this way of reading. I spent a lot of time in the New York Cafe in New York, so I heard these audiences and poets, you know, go at it like I've never seen before. And and it's fascinating and beautiful and wonderful, and it's also a form, right? It's a form in itself. So when you talk about like knowing your poem like that, do you also mean like reading it without looking at it? Because in a New York cafe, that's what struck me about slam poetry. Very few people are reading. They get up there and they stare at the audience and they just start speaking,
right,
which is in itself very alarming and confrontational, right? If you're not used to it,
right? And that and it adds another dimension, honestly, if you don't look at the page. If you don't look at the page, because you can make eye contact, you can use your body, use choreography, use like all of these sort of, again, all of these facets in embodying and becoming your poem. That's not just your voice, of course. And I think that's valuable. I think it also has the risk of, again, becoming performative, perhaps in a way that's not conducive to the poem. That's always, because I mentor slam poets, that's always something I caution my students in, is make every movement of your body intentional in your poem when you're on the stage. Because if you're just sitting here sort of narrating the poem with your body, what does that narration really do for the poem? It can come across as cheesy, and again, it can come across as really just ruining the effect of the poem and taking away from the language. So the question I sort of ask is, instead, how can the choreography and the physical presence embody that language and show your readers what you wanted to accomplish with that language? And I think that memorizing your poem is the key part of that, and that internalization process. And seeing it, it's always also interesting when you said slam is a form, because that's also how I teach my students. It is a formal constraint. You are saying that you are going to, whenever you're competing in a slam, you have to write a 3-minute long poem that is meant to be heard once by an audience, and then you're going to get an immediate score for that poem from judges that are random within the audience. So you need to work with those formal capacities and limitations. You need to scaffold your poem so that someone can hear it once and have that immediate pathos, that immediate just like intense reaction to a poem. And it lends itself to certain urgencies and certain velocities within a poem that I love within slam. And I love mentoring and seeing that come to life. And I think that is a formal process. So it doesn't really surprise me. I think Dinesh Smith was tweeting about this like earlier last year, when they were saying, it doesn't really surprise me that a lot of slam poets become formalists when they start writing for the page, because slam is a form, and slam teaches us how to become formalists in a very unique way. And I think about, for instance, Julian Randall is another poet from a slam background who is doing incredible formal work within lots of like double shovels, erasure forms, a lot of different kinds, sonnets, so many different kinds of forms, abecedarians even in his more recent Poetry Mag work. And so I think it just doesn't really surprise me, honestly, that slam poets are inhabiting this mindset.
You're going to read us 2 more poems, right? I'd love to hear another.
So on that note of form, this is a new poem. This one isn't in Birthright. So the first poem was in Birthright, I phrase this with Tooting Chainsaw. The second poem is brand new. It's my take on the Sestina form. I call it a collapsing Sestina. And it starts with 2 epigraphs. Every window is a writer of fiction, Zeina Alsus. Trap your enemies in the poem, Marwe Hillel. Defenestration fantasy. Collapsing Sestina. Today, you will wake in the belly of a beast. Tomorrow, your beloveds will push you out of a window, presuming you survive the gnash and snarl, the roaring consequence. At the center of all that kills you is a hunger tenfolded into gargantuan winter. Let me stop there. Metaphor won't be an enemy languaged against me, languaged against the next day. Memory will memoriam, fathered against certainty. You will push those whom you call issue through a window and let them bird into lingering and inevitable metaphors. And though ruptured, they will sing and sing forth the way a window knows no shock but shatter. What you will mistake for hunger's sleepless will be a half century's waning and bloodthirsting roar, and I know it from my own sleepless, my father's roaring night snarl, how it embeds, implants a rock-torn window in my throat is how I know it as an ancestral hunger. At the end of your and my and all my mind's suffering is a window into a suffering I cannot witness. Something about the eyes as windows stains the memory complicit. And what is metaphor but a mirror mistaken for a window? I will not pretty this. I will the glass roaring with your name, unknowing as a bird into a windowless flight, midriff and careening. I will the fall windless and swift. The crash and splat, the ground, a window, thirsting for light, rarefacted into shimmer, rarefacted into hunger's swell. And there, when the ground swallows you with windowed teeth, you will begin again, from beast to rupture to song to window, and I will not say your name. And I will not say your name as a window into every poem unwanted, which roared out of me despite. I will your collapse. Hypothesis, anti-window, and the space between that I am neither I nor I, but the window itself were I to bear and witness your widowed and inevitable. I would become the mirror, the wind, the spoils and conquest of, and I will not run as dough into wind, though I will it. Unfurling, I will it for every self-winding, every insomniac unreflection, the not me I witness in every window. This is my spell, and I will it into every midnight mirror, mirror in the window, window hunger against metaphor's roaring, window against hunger's roaring metaphor and shatter its toothless. And naming, wake. So yeah, that is a bit of
thank you.
newer experimental poem. do we want to go through the form, or maybe we can like let this one speak for itself?
Maybe let this one speak for itself. I'd like to hear the next one, but it's also, I mean, I'd like to say something about it, you know, but it's nice to kind of just let it be there too. As you're experimenting with this new one, are you also experimenting with your delivery, your reading of it? Because this was also a different kind of reading, the way you're breathing, the way you're, you know, emphasizing. And of course, I mean, is that something you play with to go back and forth on?
Oh, yeah.
That's why I love hearing the poet read. I imagine you could read this poem in a number of different ways, right?
Most definitely. I think with this one, something about this poem, when I first started reading it out loud early in its drafting process, I always read them out loud to myself as part of my drafting process. They had this speed to it that I think was a bit uncontrolled and unscaffolded in its earliest iterations. And I think the more I read it out loud, the more I realize, especially towards the beginning, it's a pretty slow poem. I think it wants the reader, it gives energy, it picks up momentum very much. It's a poem about defenestration. It's very, you know, that part of it can speak for itself.
Right.
But the more and more I challenge myself with this poem, the more I realize I want to sort of see the space within the poem and see the moments of pause within the poem and let them be paused. Let those moments swell and stop the poem. And that is itself integral to the poem's momentum. Momentum is always a flow. It's a two-directional mechanic, and speed is only good if there are moments of pause and slowness to contrast, I guess. So I guess thinking about that, that was in my mind as I was reading this right now.
And what is the last poem you're going to read from?
So this one is from Birthright. I'm returning back to a Birthright poem. And I hated this poem when I first wrote it. I'm going to be honest. And it's changed very little since the first draft, and perhaps because of its form. It is in a double shovel form, which is the right and left margins both are fixed. They're different quotes from the song that this poem references. And I think that's why I hated it. I hated it because it worked. And when a poem works in such a constraining form, it's hard to edit the poem without breaking it out of the form. And I think it led to me just sort of shelving this poem for like a year. And I just didn't really look at it again. And then I came back and I was like, oh my gosh, I love this poem. And it like saved me even during some of my most difficult moments. So this is written in response to French Moroccan singer Manel Ibtissam auditioning for The Voice France with a beautiful translation of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah in Arabic. And after her audition video went viral, she was doxxed and harassed for pro-Palestinian tweets and tweets that critique French Islamophobia. And so when her video went viral, a bunch of white nationalists went to her Twitter, dug up these old tweets, and she was harassed so much and essentially bullied into quitting the competition because of everything. And so this is a poem thinking about my own relationship to the Arabic language, seeing the Arabic language being put into such a public eye and seeing the consequences of that. And especially for someone who speaks up against injustices in Palestine. And so, this is my last poem. Thank you all, whoever's listening. Ode to Manel Ibtissam, singing Hallelujah on The Voice France, translated in Arabic. With thanks to Marwa Hillel. 1. Poem read from right to left, as in Arabic. I've heard this song, but never in my own tongue. The way smolder and ash, if maybe seen in the right mouth, can become gospel and not the fire who birthed it. There is your bluest prayer, which at its core is still flame, the minor fall of your Arabic, a flag which has failed us before. Somewhere, a country shrieks oud tremor, finds God on tenor lungs, the fourth, the fifth. Somewhere, a man builds his throne above the undoing, claims their ceaseless song, and writes them into lullaby. Still earth, all marble streets, empty of children who spoke brash in moonlit tongues. Yes, I've archangeled the devil from this history. Twinned the doves, bloody-handed. You ever love a country so much you'd lose your voice in its song? Somewhere the land we learned was also the land we inherited. Every memorized contour, permanent and skyward from knot bombs, hurling back up to the metal birds they came from. Manel, teach me to love a country without unmothering another. Because you sing, our history was always victory march, paradise unwinged. The revolution refused translation in you. How its alifs and yuts demand us full-throated and hollow in this. In Arabic I bleached and sent to a colonizer because so few words can keep me alive these days. English shoots cold arrows down my teeth and demands me to speak confident, like someone's broken fist didn't make a home of itself in my throat. It was first your Arabic who hallelujahed in a major key. May the God worth singing to from prayer out drew hallelujah the organ in your throat. Hallelujah the Philistine your lungs resurrect. Hallelujah the choir of restless dead running through you. Hallelujah you of this earth, its wind and stone, everything breathing, trembling at the sound of you. Two, poem read from left to right, as in English. Maybe if ash and smolder weigh the tongue, own my and never but song, this herd I bears at birth, who fire the knot, and gospel can become mouth, write the unseen, the Arabic, you're a fall, minor the flame still is core, at which prayer, bluest, your God finds tremor, ood shrieks country, a somewhere before us, failed, has which flag, above throne, builds man, a somewhere, fifth, the fourth, the lung, tenor on all earth, still lullaby, into them writes, song, ceaseless their claims, undoing the, yes, tongues, moonlit and brash, spoke who children of empty streets marbled, ever you handed bloody, doves, the twinned history, this from devil, the archangel, learned we land the somewhere song, it's in voice, your lose, so country a love, from skyward and permanent, contour memorized, every inherited we, land also is love, to me teach Menel, from Cain they burn, meddled to back hurling not bombs was always history ours, sing you because another unmothering, without country, how you in translation refuse revolution, unwinged paradise, march victory to scent, and bleached eye Arabic, and this hollow and full-throated us demands yet. And eyelids that shoots English these days, alive me keep, can words few because colonizer, a somebody like confident, speaks to me demands and teeth, my down arrows, cold who Arabic your first was at throat, my in and of itself, a home make fist broken out drew prayer from singing worth God a made key, major A, in hallelujah throat, your in organ, the hallelujah resurrect your lungs, your Palestine, the hallelujah you through running dead, restless of choir, the hallelujah of stone and wind, it's earth, this of you, hallelujah. You sound trembling, breathing everything. Three, poem read down the left margin to be sung in Manel's voice. Maybe there's a God above all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who outdrew you. Four, poem read down the right margin to be sung in Manel's voice. I've seen your flag on the marble arch. Love is not a victory march. It's a cold, broken hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Thank you.
What a beautiful third poem to end it on. Thank you for choosing that one. Somehow it seems appropriate at this moment in history as well, in so many ways. But gorgeous, you know. Also a performative poem, and seems like feels to me like a tour de force. I see if this is in a slam, you know, tens going up, some nines. People are very excited, right?
Thank you.
I don't know if you've read that one before, but it feels like one that, I mean, since we're talking about slam and have before, that kind of wows the audience, right? These are references we know. Most people know that song and also the beauty of that presentation.
Thank you.
Is that the experience audiences have? Have you not read this much to audiences?
Yeah. I think it took me reading this to audiences to realize this was a special piece. And furthermore, I guess, because when I published the piece, it went not viral, but like semi-viral. It got a lot of attention on Twitter when I first published it. I think, and especially poetic Twitter, like the people who are interested in the form, the bi-directionality of the reading, the double shovel readings of the poem, but also, I guess it just made me wonder, how the heck do I read this to audiences? Because if I read it the left to right reading, like English, I don't think people are going to get it. But if I read it right to left in Arabic, sure, I guess it's more quote-unquote legible that way. It's more, it's meant to be read that way. But I think that also it's meant to be a disconnect. It's meant to be, look what changes when you see the left to right reading versus the right to left. And also just saying out loud how the literal framing, the left and right margins, are framed by the lyrics of the song. And I felt like it was important to have the physical song present in the poem. It was a challenge. I'm like, how the heck do I read it? And I'm like, you know what? I just need to read it every way. Like, you know, this is one of those poems that, like, it's going to take a while, but it's worth the journey, you know? And it's worth, if I have to sacrifice time in my set, it's worth making space for that, because that's, whenever I make a set list, I want to sort of give people a snapshot of my poetic, not just like the poems, but like, what is my poetic? What is my practice? What is my, how do I think about language? How do I think about history and diaspora? And as you even said, this current moment, writing into a historical poetic, I think all of that, kind of comes to fruition here, in a way that I guess I hope would represent who I am, you know, and what my art is all about. And I think that's been more of my goal with these readings, especially in these weird digital spaces, with that intangibility. Because I love being in person with people. I love talking with people and having really intense and rigorous, like, dialogue about poetry and history and all of these things. And that's part of the process I love in art. And right now in digital and intangible performances, I'm just like, I need to just be my unabashed self in these performances, or else it's going to fall flat. And so this is a poem where I hope I kind of give all of myself in the poem.
Well, thank you. And I want to ask you one more question. What are you reading at the moment? What are you reading?
Oh, my gosh. So, a lot. I'm really loving Taylor Johnson's Inheritance, an absolutely incredible debut poetry collection from this year. More recently, I've also read DMZ Colony by Don Mi Choi, who won the National Book Award for Poetry. I mean, it is utterly a tremendous work of anti-colonial translation-oriented poetics, an utterly well-deserved National Book Award win. So that's kind of where my poetry brain has been at a lot recently, those two collections. I've been reading a lot of fiction as well. I'm working on a novel right now, and so I've been trying to read more fiction. And I'm really loving Luster by Raven Leilani and Bestiary by Kay Ming Chang. Those have been two books I've really loved recently. And also I've revisited the His Dark Materials series as well. In my youth, I read the first book, The Golden Compass, but I never finished it. I never read The Subtle Knife and The Amber Spyglass, but I went back and finally read them over the pandemic. And on it, like, I feel cheesy every time I talk about this, because those books kind of, like, saved my life in a way that I'm still reckoning with.
That's
really
interesting.
Cheesy.
It's not cheesy. They're seminal books in their own way. In childhoods and in growing up, right? They're almost coming of age books, or is that a stretch?
Yeah, and so I think that the Amber Spyglass, yeah, I'm really glad actually that I waited till my adulthood to read the Amber Spyglass. I don't know, it's very rare for me to like go back and immediately want to reread a book right after I finish it, like let alone a 600-page book. But immediately when I finished it, I was just like, I need to go back and marvel at this language and this story again. Like, it was just, it, yeah, it completely, like, it got me through a really, my roughest moment in quarantine, and came to me at a time I needed it most. And that's the thing with these books. I think that, like, whenever a book really impacts me, it's a function of the book itself, of course, but also timing. And I'm really fortunate that the Amber Spyglass and Phil Pullman's His Dark Materials came to me at the right time, because I needed it. I needed to, and it restored, I guess, my sense of like wonder in the world, and in a time when I just could not see anything. So yeah, cheesy as that might sound, that is the honest answer.
And, I like that.
And thank you for giving space for me to answer these questions honestly and thoughtfully. And for, yeah, for this interview, it was just really, thank you for seeing my work and giving space to my work, and for all of your insights and kind words.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.